The Foreign Area Officer podcast is not an official audio production. The views shared in the recordings are the personal views of the interviewee and the host. They are for informational purposes only and not necessarily those of the Department of Defense or its components. The United States Department of Defense and the United States Army make no endorsement of its content. Hello everyone, this is Michael Hill with the Foreign Area Officer Podcast. Today my guest is Colonel Retired John Haseman. Colonel Haseman is a member of the Defense Intelligence Agency Defense Attaché Service Hall of Fame and a specialist in Southeast Asian political military affairs. He served in Vietnam as a military intelligence officer and district-level advisor and is one of the few military intelligence officers to earn the Combat Infantryman badge. His Vietnam service led him into the Foreign Area Officer Program, where he served overseas tours in Indonesia, Burma, and Thailand. A prolific writer, Colonel Haseman is the editor of the Foreign Area Officer Association's Journal of International Affairs. Colonel Haseman, thank you for coming onto the podcast today.
Good to be here.
Sir, I wonder if we could just start out by covering a little bit about where you come from and how you came into the Army, and we'll jump off from there.
Fine. I start by saying I'm an Army brat. My father was a career Army officer, Corps of Engineers. He actually swore me into the Army when I graduated from ROTC at the University of Missouri in Columbia. At the time, I had still have very poor eyesight. I was a field artillery ROTC school, but I was not eligible for commissioning as a combat arms officer. So I chose military intelligence branch as a political science major. It seemed to fit. So that was way back in 1963. My first assignment was not to an intelligence course, but was rather to the infantry officers basic course at Fort Benning. In those days, all MI officers went to Fort Benning for the infantry officers course before they went to intelligence school. I thought it was a great idea. I enjoyed it. A lot of my classmates thought it was a waste of time, but I thought it was very important. So that was my base in the Army. As an MI officer, my first course was the basic officers intelligence course at Fort Hollaberg, Maryland, long before the move to Fort Huachuca. I had a couple of basically not so important assignments at the time. I was an OBV2, obligated for 2 years. And they assigned me to Fort Meade, Maryland, which was close to my home of record at the time. But I enjoyed what I was doing. I extended on active duty in order to take the human intelligence officer's course. And from there, I went to Korea for my first overseas assignment. Returned from there, took the counterintelligence officer's course, and got my first command assignment as a commander of the Fort Ritchie Field Office, 109th MI Group. Where at the time we spent a lot of time doing security investigations. It was the underground Pentagon at Site R in Pennsylvania.
Interesting.
That was 1965-66. The Vietnam War was heating up. I called my assignments officer and told him I wanted to volunteer to go to Vietnam if I could choose an assignment. And they said, sure, you volunteer, we'll guarantee it. I asked for a tactical intelligence assignment. They sent me to the 9th Infantry Division's 9th Military Intelligence Detachment. In those days, a division's combat intelligence detachment was 29 people. And my specific job was commander in chief of the interrogation of prisoners of war section. Tet Offensive came in 1968. We did some changes, and I was assigned to the forward division base camp at Dong Tam on the Mekong River. And I was the forward commander for both the counterintelligence and the tactical intelligence and the interrogation of prisoners. I enjoyed the first half of that. I had really good leadership. My boss that I really worked for was the assistant division commander, Brigadier General William Knowlton, finest military boss I had in my career. Second half was not so good. Change of command, change of personalities, not so much fun. I had my career saved by General Abrams, Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Forces in Vietnam. He required every U.S. unit that was still in country to have full-time liaison with the local government, the local Army units there were. So I was detached from the detachment and made the full-time liaison officer to the province of Dintung, to the 7th Arvin Division, and to all of the intelligence people working in the city of Mito. And that is basically the start of my interest in what became the FAO career pattern. So I'm now a young captain. I've had 4 years of active duty. And by that time, I had pretty much decided I wanted to be a career officer.
And was it unusual at the time for someone to want to be a career officer?
It was. I was a 2-year reserve officer on an extension. And my assignment to Vietnam was also an extension. I could have gotten out anytime I wanted. I actually left active duty after that assignment so I could get a master's degree at the University of Kansas. From there on, I basically became very much interested in what became the FAO program. My second assignment in Vietnam came after my career course, and I asked again, volunteered to go back to Vietnam as an advisor. In those days, a big emphasis was on what became the Phung Long or Phoenix program. It got a bad name in some aspects, but it was basically targeted against the Viet Cong infrastructure, the shadow government, if you will, that ran the war in the South. And I became a district level Phung Long advisor. My duties were nominally to collate intelligence and target anybody we could find that we could confirm was a member of the Viet Cong infrastructure. This is 1971. A huge reduction in the U.S. military was taking place. What used to be 6 or 8 men, district advisory teams had become 2 or 3 men. I spent my first 2 weeks or so working strictly in the Phung Long Intel little office, and it was clear I was wasting my time. But I went to my boss, who was an armor officer, a district senior advisor, and told him I did not want to be a full-time Phung Long Intel guy. I wanted to be his deputy district senior advisor and participate in the regular tactical operations that were going on. He was surprised a bit because my predecessor did not wish to do that. He was purely an Intel guy. So he basically said, okay, let's give it a try. Less than a month later, I was moved from the intelligence slot to the infantry slot as the deputy district senior advisor. And I stayed in that intel assignment through 2 districts, 18 months as an advisor. I guess I was one of the very few MI officers that was awarded the combat infantryman's badge. Wow. And that solidified what I want to do for the rest of my career. I wrote about that. My most recent book covered my 18 months as a district level advisor in the Mekong Delta.
Okay.
And it might be of interest. We can talk about it later.
Is that book available in any place in particular?
It is available on Amazon. It's okay. Available from McFarland Publishing. The title is long, but it's easy to remember. It's called In the Mouth of the Dragon, Memoir of a District Advisor in the Mekong Delta. The Dragon was the Mekong River, and my province was an arrow-shaped province where the last split of the Mekong River took place. And in Vietnamese language, Mekong is dragon, and we were in the dragon's mouth. That's it right. Was an interesting time. And by the time I finished, I had spent 14 of the 18 months as a deputy district senior advisor. I spent 3 months of it as a district senior advisor, still a captain, when an NVA regiment invaded my district. And that was an interesting time, and we actually won that battle. And that's what told me that this was my business. I was good at working with other countries' military. It was a very interesting time to be in Vietnam at the end of the war. I was actually one of the very, very last district advisors to leave the field after the Paris peace talk.
Wow.
Required us to be out of our district by the 28th of January, 1973. I became a ceasefire violation because the district that I was in was the home district of a lady by the name of Madam Nguyen Thi Dinh. She was the Viet Cong foreign minister at the Paris peace talks, and the VC wanted to give her that district, her home district, as a fully Viet Cong operating district So there was no ceasefire.
I see.
People, they, in the calculation, they said, is the advisor still there? Yes, he was. And me and my interpreter stayed on until the North Vietnamese and the International Control Commission persuaded the Viet Cong to pull back from their land grab operation so that I could drive to the ferry to the province capital in Ben Tre. And it took about 2 weeks.
Wow. Was that about four total years in Vietnam that you spent?
No, two and a half years.
Okay.
2.5 years. First year was 1 year. Second year was should have been 18 months. It turned out to be 19.
Okay.
Actually 20, because I had a 30-day leave in there. When I left Vietnam in 1973, I came back. I was sent back to the Pentagon. I actually was on on orders to go to Cambodian language school and to go to Cambodia as an advisor. The war is over. That slot went away.
Uh-huh.
I show up in Washington and I say, what are we going to do with you? And I said, okay, I'm here. I'm all psyched up for language school. Send me the Thai language course. And they did. And it was a revelation to a young captain that I had asked twice in a row for an assignment, and twice in a row I got what I asked for. And that kind of was the way I operated my career management for the rest of my military career.
My ops NCO, when I was an attaché in Chad, had a similar way of going about picking his assignments. He said, I don't take any jobs unless they're nominative positions. If it's not a nominative position, I'm not going to do it, because those are the best jobs, especially for NCOs. And I don't want a job that just anybody is going to do. So I think that says a lot for sort of the assignments that you picked. Clearly, you didn't want just any run-of-the-mill military intelligence assignment. You wanted something that was going to set you apart and that it was going to be something you would enjoy.
That's a very good summary. I had some very good advice from my dad. He retired about 3 or 4 years after I came on active duty. He only gave me a little bit of advice because he didn't pressure any of us as to what career to take. But when I looked like I was going to stay in the Army, he gave me two pieces of advice. One of them was, keep the troops out of the sun and never bullshit the old man.
Both
and
good.
That was succinct, but when you stop and think about it, that's a lot about what you do in the military. You take care of your troops first, then you do the mission, and you always tell the truth to your boss. And it worked for me for 31 and a half years.
So was your time in the Thai language course already with the intent of making a switch to the Foreign Area Officer Corps?
No, the program hadn't yet been started.
I see.
I actually went to Thailand in an MI job. I was, again, a commander. I had a command of a field office in Udorn Thani in northeastern Thailand. And while I was there, and this is now 1974, I applied for the program that governed American advisors in Vietnam. And they came back and said, that program has been dropped. We've combined it with an intelligence program, and it's now called the Foreign Area Officers Program. Would you be interested? I said, yes, sign me up. And I was in Thailand. I'd had a year of language school. I was in a utilization assignment. I had spent Now, I'm going into my third year as a Southeast Asia experience. And so I was fully blessed as a Southeast Asia FAO with no FAO training, period. And although I was in an MI assignment, it was considered peripheral as a FAO assignment. And that was my utilization tour as a FAO.
I see. What was your assignment there in Thailand as a military intelligence officer? Was it already doing attaché work?
No, I was in northeastern Thailand in Udorn Thani. At the time, there was a very large Army security agency based there with big ears in an elephant cage. And my little field office was in charge of security investigations for them. We also had a parallel mission of liaison with the local government, the local police, the local military. And as I, as a young captain, and regularly meeting with the provincial governor, with the two-star general that's the military commander in that part of Thailand. Heady stuff, but the neat thing was that they actually wanted to talk to me, even though I was a young captain.
Right.
And that's how things get started. You look for something that you want to do, and it works out. And I came back from Thailand, mostly because the Thai government was nervous after the Vietnam War ended. They'd sent two divisions to Vietnam. I'm fond of saying that if the Vietnamese really were mad at the Thais, the only thing that would have stopped them on the way to Bangkok was the traffic. The then civilian government basically asked the American military to leave. I left early. I was on orders to go to Laos. There was just an army attaché. The Pathet Lao, of course, had taken over Laos after the war, and they said, we don't need any more American assistant attachés here. So the army sent me to Fort Leavenworth to get ready for the Command and General Staff College.
And what was the reason that they ordered you to leave?
The Thai government did not want to be seen as against the new Vietnamese communist government. They had some fear that the Vietnamese would be angry at Thailand for sending troops to fight against them.
I see.
And I think they just thought that was a good way to get back in a neighbor's good graces by asking most of the Americans to leave.
I see.
As you'll see in a minute, it did affect my follow-on assignments. I was all set. So I'm in Fort Leavenworth. I spent about 6 months waiting for the course to start. I was a war gamer, computerized war games. I was on the red team. It was a good assignment, a CONUS FAO billet. I got promoted to major, and while I'm sitting in a staff college course, the personnel came around and said, would you guys like to do next? I said, I want to go back to Thailand. I'm language trained. They said, we've lost most of our assignments, and I do have an assignment in Indonesia dealing with training. It's a FAO billet. Would you be interested? I said, yes. He said, you have to go to language school first. I said, of course. So I went to Monterey for my second Asian language, Indonesian. And what they had described to me as a training job was, in fact, being the manager of the International Military Education and Training Program, the IMET program in Indonesia. I arrived just in time to take over what was then the largest IMET program in the world for Indonesia, and spent my first 2 years in Indonesia doing that, in the process of which I'm sending hundreds of Indonesian officers to schools in the American schoolhouse, going all over the country, working with the Indonesian Army. And then I became the Army Division Chief for my third year, meeting a bit more senior officers. I'll put in a plug right now for language, the importance of language, and the importance of follow-on assignments in the same country. But I had a two-year assignment in Indonesia, which I extended for the third year. It's time for me to come back to the States. The fellow that had preceded me as Army Division Chief was now working in the class director's office at Leavenworth. I had bought a house in Leavenworth. I asked them if they had a job for me, and they said, yeah, we've got a FAO billet. You'll be on the staff, not as an instructor, but as a staff member of the staff college. So I became the director of allied activities. I was in charge of all of the foreign officers at Command and General Staff College, except for their education, their actual classwork. And the class director for the first 3 or 4 months I was there had been a fellow advisor in the same province with me in the Kenwa province. His name was Roger Donlan, Congressional Medal of Honor winner in Vietnam, the first one. We'd become friends in Vietnam. We became better friends at Fort Leavenworth. Sadly, he passed away at the end of January, 5 days short of his 90th birthday. One of the finest men I've had the privilege of calling a friend. But anyway, I was sitting there enjoying my life as a staff officer at Command and General Staff College, and the assignments office called from Washington and said, Haseman, did you really mean it when you said you wanted to go back to Southeast Asia? I said, yes. What did you have in mind? He said, we want to send you back to Indonesia as the assistant army attaché. And mind you, I'd only been back in CONUS for 6 months. And I said, that would be great, except that's an aviator's billet. We had a C-12 aircraft and the DAO there. He said, yeah, but the man that was going to take that job can't go. And we told the defense attaché he could have either a FAO or an aviator, but we didn't have time to get somebody that had both specialties. So he picked you, and I had to negotiate with Leavenworth to stay through the end of the class year. So almost exactly 12 months after I arrived, I'm going back for my second tour in Indonesia as the assistant army attaché. By the time I got there, it was 1982. All of the young captains and lieutenants I'd sent to school in the U.S. to my first tour were now colonels. Many of them were important figures that we needed to know. So I had a lot of friends. Again, the importance of a second follow-on assignment in the country is important. I had 3 years as the assistant army attaché. I had a great time. We had, like I say, a C-12 aircraft. And when the defense attaché didn't want to fly, I did. Got to see a good part of Indonesia. I served in that job from 1982 to 1985. Time to go back to the U.S. and assignments officers called and said, we have a job for you at Hawaii. Would you like that? I said, where is it? They said, I'm not sure yet, but it'll be somewhere either in the U.S. Army Pacific or in the Pacific Command. I said, no, I want to go to the Army staff in Washington. He could hardly believe it that I was turning down an assignment to Hawaii. But I did. And they did get me a job on the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence in Washington. And I was this Army's senior intelligence analyst for Southeast Asia. It was a FAO billet. So now I've had Thailand assignment, Leavenworth assignment, an Indonesia assignment, a second Indonesia assignment, and now the Army staff, consecutive FAO assignments.
What was the reason that you were so sure that that assignment in Army staff? What was the draw for you at the time?
Well, there was a couple of things going on there. One was, I wouldn't say that I thought Hawaii was a trap, but it occurred to me that maybe they offered that job to people, and if somebody accepted the assignment, they might not be so high on the list. I don't know whether that was true or not.
Interesting.
But I really felt, with my knowledge on Southeast Asia and now two languages, that I would be a good asset on the Army staff. Maybe assignments officers are surprised when you ask to go to the Pentagon. But I did, and I was very fortunate. The AXE at the time was Major General Weinstein, Sidney T. Weinstein, known as Tom to his friends. One of the finest gentlemen I ever worked for. He tried to make people think he was a cowboy. He smoked. He chewed tobacco. He used a Coke can as a spittoon. But in fact, he was an absolutely brilliant man, very good intelligence officer, and it was fun working for him. I was fortunate, or unfortunate, that the big issue during my time there was Philippine people power. When President Marcos had his leading political rival assassinated when he got off an airplane, his wife, Cory Aquino, began a very large people power demonstration, and it was significant enough that I spent about 2 months briefing the Army Chief of Staff or the Vice Chief of Staff almost every day about what was going on in the Philippines. Of course, it was an all sorts briefing. We had photographs. We had all kinds of good information. So I was briefing General Wickham or General Thurman almost every day. General Weinstein, of course, attended those briefings, and a fellow by the name of Norman Schwarzkopf was an attendee from Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations Office. And those guys were all known as being pretty tough questioners, and as long as you could answer their questions and you knew what you're talking about, it was easy peasy, and I enjoyed it. By then, people power had achieved what it was trying to do, things quieted down. It was not boring, but it wasn't significant, I guess you'd say. So while I'm taking a deep breath and not having to report to the Army Chief of Staff every day, by now I'm a lieutenant colonel. And the colonel's branch at Milpersen had a publication then, I don't know if they still do, called The Eagle's Eye. And they sent it, as a matter of course, to fairly senior lieutenant colonels, I guess those of us who were in or approaching promotion consideration. And on the front page of one of those issues, there was a box with a big border around it, and it was called the Top 10. And these were assignments that Colonel's Branch was having trouble finding qualified people to take. And right at the top of that list was Defense Attaché Rangoon, Burma. It's now 1986. I had been my career goal, thought that I would go back about 1990 as a defense attaché to Indonesia if everything worked out. And it didn't take any time at all for me to say I could go to Burma and be the attaché there, and then I could transfer. So I picked up the phone, and I called the Milpherson assignments officer, identified myself, and said, what I'd like to do is take that Burma assignment. And he said, oh, okay, what else? And I said, and then I want you to send me directly to Indonesia and be the defense attaché in Indonesia. You could see his mind turning. I said, there's two tough assignments that he's got a qualified guy. Maybe this will work. So I said, okay, you got them both. I said, there's a couple of problems here. He said, what's that? And I said, I have to be an 06. He says, some of the sweetest words I ever heard, you don't have to worry about that. The other thing was I had to get released from the normal 3-year lock-in on the Army staff. He said, we can help you with that, but you have to have General Weinstein's assistance to do that. So I went in one day to see General Weinstein to ask for a favor, and I said, I got my appointment. He said, what can I do for you, John? I said, I told him I wanted to be the defense attaché in Rangoon. I'd have to leave coming summer to go to language school, and I wanted him to release me. General Weinstein, I can still see him. He sits back in those big fancy general officer chairs, and he looks at me and he says, if you stay in MI, John, you have general officer potential. If you go back to another attaché job, you're going to give that up. I want you to go home and think about that. So I did. I should interject here that I've been a lifelong bachelor. I never married. And so I didn't have to ask anybody's right. permission at home. I gave him a week, and then right. I went back to see him, and I said, I have good MI credentials, and I appreciate what you said about me. But I said, I'm really now a FAO officer. My last many assignments have been FAOs. And the last time I was in an MI job was in Vietnam. And he said, John, I owe you one for your work on the Philippines. I'll approve it. Like I said, he was a great man to work for. He took care of his troops. And not only that, he got me the Army staff badge, and he wished me good luck. And I'll come back to General Weinstein here in a little bit. So now I'm going back to language school. This time it's at the State Department in Washington for my third Asian language. I did come out on the 06 list, had an interesting time in language school.
So I have to stop you there and say, what do you mean you had an interesting time in language school?
Well, it was my third language. My first one had been Thai. The second one was Indonesian. Indonesian was
right.
comparatively easy. It's rated at the same level as Spanish. And of course, all of the letters are in English script. It's not no trouble learning how to read it or write it. Now Burma's, you're back in a strange alphabet, a strange script. Nothing like Thai, except that it's Asian. But I did okay. I managed to get a good enough score, a 3-3, to go on to my assignment.
That's fantastic.
The interesting part came because as the attaché designate to Burma, I got invited to a lot of the Washington social functions, at which the Burmese attaché of the United States was a frequent attendee. And every time I met him, he'd look up, literally look up, and said, oh, not yet, meaning I was still wearing my lieutenant colonel's leaves and not a colonel's eagle. And about the fourth or fifth time he'd said that, I notified DIA and I said, this is getting a little annoying. They said, yep, we're going to frock you. I should have said I did make the 06 list while I was still on the Army staff, but it was going to be a while. So they frocked me, and I spent the last, 4 or 5 months in Washington wearing colonel's eagles. And obviously it was helpful when I got to Rangoon as a colonel, even though the only people that knew I wasn't was my ambassador and my staff. But Rangoon was interesting when we got there.
Tell me about interesting. What was interesting about Rangoon at the time? I know we have a lot of issues today, but I can't imagine what it was 50 years ago.
It was 50 years behind Bangkok, economically and commercially, infrastructure, everything. It was only a 1-hour flight from Bangkok to Rangoon, and it was like stepping back 50 years when you got off the plane. Rangoon in those days was dilapidated. It suffered from a very poor military government. And, of course, my job is to establish a relationship with the host country military. That was hard. When you don't respect the military, it's hard, to be a good attaché, but I did my best. We had our mission, and that was my marching orders. I should interject here, just we can talk about embassy relations later, but I already identified General Knowlton as my best military boss of my career. My best boss, period, was the ambassador I worked for in Burma. The Honorable Burton Levin, sadly he's passed away, was just absolutely amazing individual. We arrived 3 days apart, and 3 years later we left. I left 2 weeks before he did. So we had 3 full years of a very difficult time together. We were still trying the first 6 months or so that I was there to reestablish an IMET program with the Burmese to be able to meet their military. But the Burmese military was strictly prohibited from meeting any foreign diplomat. Prohibited. We were only allowed routinely to talk to the 3 foreign liaison officers, Army, Navy, and Air Force. And if we had to see a more senior officer, they would attempt to set it up. There was no military-to-military rapport in Burma. Nonetheless, we did our best. We tried to keep up on what was going on. And then came 8-8-88, August 8th, 1988. The morning, I should go back. I got there in April of 1987. In September of 87, this quixotic Burmese government suddenly demonetized the 3 largest bills in their money without recompense. In other words, you can't exchange these for the new currency. You're just out of luck. It didn't apply to the diplomats. I had a 5-person office, and the embassy had only 30 people. It was one of the smaller embassies around the world. And we pooled all of our talents to getting to our contacts and our friends and certainly our household staff. And we collected all of their money, their cash, their bills, and exchanged them as if they were ours. And it was all within the rules, so nobody did anything illegal. But we got through that with a lot of friends, you might say. But then things just got worse. There were clashes between mostly students and the military over the money issue. There were a lot of violence, a lot of shooting, policemen raping college girls, and that sort of thing. And it was a tough time. We had a lot of worries about security for our small embassy and our embassy staff. But I woke up in the morning on the 8th of August. Normally, our embassy was open from 7:30 in the morning till 3:30 in the afternoon. You get in before it got really hot. And so about 7:15, I'm leaving the house in my official sedan. We all have, you remember those old handheld radio things? Probably this was in the 1980s. We had one of those in the car. We got about 2 blocks away from my house, and then we get this emergency over the radio. Somebody help, help. I'm in a whole crowd of Burmese and the army is shooting at us. That was only a couple of blocks away. And so I told the driver to step on it, and sure enough, we came up on the intersection that he described, and there was about a squad of 10 or 15 soldiers in the middle of the intersection and shooting down the street at a crowd of hundreds and hundreds of Burmese that are frantically trying to get away. They had been in an anti-government demonstration at the Shwe Dagon Pagoda, which is the largest and holiest Buddhist religious structure in the entire country. And here's our embassy political counselor on his way to work in his official sedan, and he's on the same street, and all of a sudden there's shooting is going on, and that's why he called. So I pulled up to the intersection and very slowly got out of the car, got my diplomatic ID card out, and found the it was either lieutenant or captain, the officer in charge, and I walked right up to him and identified myself by name and rank and position, and said, "You're shooting an American diplomatic vehicle with an American diplomat in it. You've got to stop the shooting right now." I didn't mention that they were all shooting at hundreds and hundreds of Burmese civilians, but never mind. The officer was very angry. I was speaking in Burmese, and I repeated it in English just in case. So he answered me in Burmese and said, "You are interfering with a military operation. You must leave now." This is all in Burmese. I repeated it in English, and then he, in English, yells 3 words, "You go now." And before I could come up with a suitable response, I heard one of his soldiers, probably an NCO, in Burmese saying, we could shoot him and pretend it was an accident.
That's pretty bold.
Yeah. My driver heard that and said, sir, we have to get out of here right now. I was ready to leave. And I had the assistance of several of the soldiers who put their hands on me and shoved me into the back door of the car. Two of them stuck their rifles in the open window. And my driver put it in reverse and we got out of there and got down to the embassy, put the word out quickly. The ambassador told, with only 30 people in the mission, it was easy to say, if you have not gone to work yet, don't go. And that was the start of 2 or 3 months of really nasty violence. We figured that 1 week in August that there were about 3,000 people killed in Rangoon alone and probably 5,000 wounded. Very nasty actions by the army. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And all of a sudden there were no troops and no police on the streets. And we couldn't figure out what was going on. The Burmese figured that they'd just beaten the army and won. And so they started a whole series of larger and larger demonstrations and marches calling for democracy. And they marched them right past our embassy, which was right across the street from martial law headquarters, across the park, sorry. We figured that on some of those days, there were over 100,000 people walking past our embassy calling for democracy. And then in the end of September, the 19th of September, the army came back out and started another round of shooting. We figured another 8 to 10,000 killed and wounded just in Rangoon. And the people got the word, they got the message, they stopped demonstrating. But we were under a curfew from 6 p.m. till 6 a.m. for about 6 months. And any relationship we had with the military became strictly formal. We had to talk to them about some things. We did a lot of protests. My ambassador always took me with him when he was calling on a minister, because all of the ministers were military officers. So we're seeing the Minister of Foreign Affairs, but it's an army general. And the idea was that he would show that the U.S. military and the U.S. civilians were of the same mind. This is the U.S. policy. No favors coming from the U.S. military. And it worked. So that was the last part of my 3 years in Burma. And it's now 1990. Bless their hearts, the assignments officer kept his word. I had 2 weeks home leave and consultations in Washington and transferred from Rangoon to Jakarta as the defense attaché in Jakarta. And my third assignment in Indonesia. The big issue with the U.S. then at that time was the issue of East Timor and human rights, both in East Timor and Indonesia in general. Indonesia had a very strong military. They did not govern the country, but they were very influential. And by the time I came back as a defense attaché, all of those lieutenants and captains I'd sent to school in the 1970s and 80s were now general officers. The man that I helped with English conversation, because he was going to a master's degree program in Monterey, the postgraduate school, was now the Armed Forces Commander-in-Chief. Two of my classmates at Leavenworth were the defense and the Armed Forces Assistant for Intel and the Assistant for Operations, and a third one was the number two. So I had personal contacts and personal friends who took my phone calls and granted me appointments that maybe other people didn't get. And so I'll go back to what I started early, and we can cover this later. The importance of repeat assignment, it might not happen to every person in every country, but when it does, it's magic. It really works. My main issue as the attaché for the U.S. was the East Timor situation. East Timor was not open to foreign diplomats until 1988, 2 years before I got back there. But when I arrived, the Indonesians were very insistent that I go and see the situation in East Timor. So I agreed. The ambassador agreed. DIA agreed. And my first visit was with a condition that I go wherever I wanted and I meet with whoever I wanted. And they agreed. They wanted me as somebody they knew. We know you. We trust you. We know you will tell us what and what you think. So I did. I went. That was the first of 12 visits in 4 years in Indonesia to East Timor. No other European diplomat could go because the European Union refused to let their diplomats go to East Timor. That very first 2 weeks, I met everybody that I wanted to meet, including Bishop Bello, the Catholic Bishop of East Timor, later Nobel Peace Prize laureate. And when I went back on repeated tours and asked to see him, I always did. You probably picked up on one of the second reasons I might have gotten into the Hall of Fame. But that was a three-year assignment. I extended for a fourth year. Between my 3 years as a ARMA and my 4 years as a defense attaché, I, of course, trained advised a whole series of FAO trainees that came to attend the Indonesian Army Staff College. At least three of them made 06. One became my successor as the DAD in Indonesia. One became defense attaché in Malaysia, mm-hmm. basically the same language. A third one became an 06, reverted to a special forces background and came within an inch and three lines on a promotion list to becoming a general. But 1994, I had 6 months left to mandatory retirement. My successor was trained and ready to come. He had been one of my staff college students. So I took my last 6 months off and went to Fort Leavenworth. I was the senior 06 on post. They didn't have a job for me. The general that was the commandant of Leavenworth, the staff college, said, "Haysman, if we have anything we need you to do, we'll give you a call, but you don't need to come in." So I didn't. I was acting division chief for people to go on leave. I took a team of five other officers to South Asia for a month of TDY and instruction in Bangladesh, India, Nepal, and Pakistan. So I had things to do, but I had a home there, and it was a good way to finish my career. So 1994, I finished at Leavenworth. I retired January 31st, 1995, 31 and a half years, counting my master's degree time in the reserves. And you'd say, okay, he retired in Grand Junction, Colorado, but I'm still a FAO. I consulted academic institutions, government institutions in the U.S. and Australia, and did an awful lot of writing, mostly about Indonesia, but also on Vietnam, as I mentioned. And I'm still doing that. I still consider myself a FAO. I still follow affairs in the region and reasonably up to date on what's going on. So that's my life story, and I'm sticking to it.
That's an incredible story, sir, and I appreciate you sharing it. In the first episode that I did for this podcast, I had a conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Wes Cheney, and we talked mm-hmm. about how the FAO job has changed over the years and how it might change in the future. And his comment was that less any personnel or management policies that you see over the years, the FAO job really hasn't changed in the entire time that the Army's been training and producing FAOs. So it's interesting for me to hear some of the stuff you're talking about. And we still face a lot of these same issues, a lot of these same challenges today of dealing with the host nation, dealing with sometimes hostile militaries, and also trying to get back in region to keep our regional specialization alive. Have you ever been able to travel back to the region and visit the places that you worked before and keep in contact with people?
I have. I would say from 95 when I retired here until probably about 2010 or 2012, I lectured on cruise ships in Southeast Asian routes.
Interesting.
I lectured in universities both in the U.S. and Australia. I have an Australia connection because one of my sisters has lived there for more than 50 years, so I went there a lot. And my Australian colleagues, especially from Indonesia, and I stayed in touch over the years. I stayed in touch with my Indonesian counterparts, still do. One of them is about to become president of Indonesia. I sent him to Fort Benning and Fort Bragg when he was a lieutenant and a captain in 1978 and 1980. Still would take my phone call if I picked up the phone, but I think he's got more things to do now. Anyway, a couple of things that you said I would say are still the same. My career was unusual at the time because I was not going back and forth between my basic branch and my FAO specialty. That was for several reasons. I think one was MI branch did not begrudge me the time I spent as a FAO because I was basically contributing to the MI mission in one way or another, either in representational duties or reporting, knowing what was going on, having some good contacts. Had I been an infantry officer, that might have not happened.
Right.
I might have either not gotten my promotions, or I would have just jumped back and forth and wouldn't have had the 20 years in a row that I was fortunate to have. So it was what I wanted to do. I make a lot of caveats. I never married. I didn't have a wife and family and kids. I had to worry about their schooling, where they lived overseas. Was it safe for a wife and kids? I didn't have that issue, and that most certainly is an issue in today's world. I wanted to do what I wanted, and I kept asking, as you referred to earlier, I kept asking for jobs that were difficult. The Army couldn't find somebody to be the defense attaché in Burma. The Army was really surprised when I went back to Vietnam the second time and said, I want to be a real advisor, not an MI guy. I don't know how many MI officers were awarded to CIB in Vietnam, but not very many. A lot of MI guy advisors were killed in Vietnam. A lot were wounded. I was fortunate. When I went back to Ham Long District as a district senior advisor during the NVA offensive in 1972, I followed our province S2 advisor who had previous infantry experience but had branch transferred to MI. He was sent out because they needed help out there, and my district chief had just been killed and my boss wounded. So I had to stay where I was. And Bill was killed on day one of his assignment in that district. Wow. So that's when I went back out there. It's certainly not why I got in the Hall of Fame, but it was key to my background. Right. I really never forgot those 3 months at Fort Benning and how important it was to know what infantry guys did and what they learned and how they thought. And I carried that forward, certainly in Vietnam and a lesser extent in Burma, when we were worried we had to do an evacuation of our embassy in Burma. I didn't even mention that, and the ambassador put me in charge of arranging that. So a combination of, I think, being very well prepared. The Army prepared me well. They sent me to schools I needed to go to. They sent me to language training that I needed to have. They sent me in assignments that maybe people didn't want or found to be difficult, and I did okay. So I'm sure that there are hundreds and hundreds of FAO officers today that have the same mindset, but the circumstances might be different. All I can say is, you know what your job is, you do it the best you can, and take care of the people around you while you're doing it. And we didn't lose any of our people in Rangoon. We didn't lose any of the people that worked for me in Vietnam. It was a good ride. I had a reputation of knowing what I was doing. And the best example of that I can give you, and I refer back to my good friend and my good boss, General Weinstein, who said, I owe you one for the Philippines. I'm going to approve your assignment to Burma. When things got really tough in Burma, just before those shooting began on the 8th of August, the embassy did a composite report on what the situation was, which our office contributed to. But it wasn't as strong as I felt that it was. And I went to see the ambassador after that, went in and said, I want to do another report because, and I explained why. And he said, do you have anything firm that you can put this on? I said, no, but I know the Army better than anybody else in this building, the Burmese right. Army. So I wrote that report. He approved it, wrote on the bottom of it, ambassador has seen and approves this report. And things are getting tense. And there was a meeting in the tank in the Pentagon. And what do we do about Burma? Are we going to have to do an evacuation? Is there a risk to Americans? And they did the briefing. I heard about this a number of years later, certainly not right at the time. General Weinstein was in that briefing, as you would expect. And he said, what does the attaché say? The briefing officer read the executive summary of my IR, which said the Burmese army is going to shoot people if the army leadership tells them to shoot. And when they shoot, we might not know about it until it happens. American lives are going to be at risk, which is exactly what happened. But this report went in before that all happened. General Weinstein, bless his heart, said, if Haysman said it, you can take it to the bank. The finest thing anybody has ever said about my reporting as an attaché. Unfortunately, I was right. Fortunately, Washington knew about it before it happened. There is a lot of situations around the world like that today where people are looking at risks, looking at the situation. Is it safe for Americans? Do we have to take steps, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And I would just observe that anybody that's going out to a job in that situation, just be very sure of your relations with your embassy staff. Know who you can trust if there's going to be a problem. Who can you rely on? It may not be the person that you think. And when things get tough, you can be expected to take a leadership role, whether that's your job or not. That was my history. I guess it was an unusual one.
Certainly unusual. And I think you, sir, you touched on one of the values of foreign area officers, I think, that often gets overlooked. And that is that idea of being an early warning for events happening in country, not just for the Department of Defense, but for the United States government as a whole. Because oftentimes when things go bad or go from bad to worse in a country, the military is going to have a hand in it one way or another, either trying to prevent it from happening or being the instigator of the change in the country. And it's always going to be the foreign area officers that are going to be on the front line. And like you said, too, we have U.S. citizens living in probably every country in the world. And once things start happening and the military starts shooting, it becomes our responsibility as the U.S. government to do what we can to protect and to help the U.S. citizens in those countries. And having that early warning and having the relationships and the notoriety of being trustworthy does worlds for helping us prepare and be prepared for when things do go bad in the country.
I agree completely. I was in some unusual situations that I was called to do something I didn't really expect to do. I did not expect to become an infantry advisor in Vietnam, but I did because that's what the situation required. I didn't expect to have to do an evacuation in Burma because the Burmese people were so friendly to Americans, but the Army wasn't. And perhaps in Indonesia, I was trusted by the Indonesians to report what I saw and what I believed about East Timor and a lot of other things. I had excellent ambassadors in all of my overseas assignments. They were all career ambassadors. They all had worked with military personnel, attaches, and tactical units. And when I went in to see my ambassador to tell him about what the Burmese army was going to do or what the Indonesian army was doing in East Timor, they believed me too. But I was very clear in doing the same thing with my Indonesian counterparts. Because when I came back from East Timor, having your own airplane, you don't have that in Indonesia anymore, but I did. And so to get out to East Timor, we had to stop in Bali, where the two-star command headquarters was, coming and going, and briefing him on the way out and debriefing him on the way back. And the same thing with the intelligence in Jakarta. And for 4 years, my advice to the Indonesians was, the people in East Timor are not so much anti-Indonesia as they are anti-army. You can't tell them what you need to do, but in my view, if the army got out of the villages and either stayed in the field hunting the guerrillas but not trying to run a village and cities, you'd probably be in better shape. And they'd shake their heads and say, oh, you've talked to the wrong people. The next time you go, we'll have better briefings. My story never changed. Interestingly enough, 1999 was the vote of choice. They don't call it a referendum. These Timorese were given a choice to vote whether to remain part of Indonesia or to be an independent country. And I was in Indonesia about 6 months before this was to happen. And my friends asked me how things were going to go. And my suggestion to them was 51-49. And who's going to win? They asked me. I said, whoever does a better job of convincing the East Timorese that it's their benefit to follow your side. And, okay. As you, those of you who followed the history of East Timor, it was just the opposite. The army went on a rampage, a lot of violence, a lot of destruction, a lot of killings. And then I'm back in Indonesia again, and I said, okay, how's it going to be? And I said, it's going to be 80-20. And they said that we're going to win by that much. And I said, no, you're going to lose. And they didn't believe me. They said, how could you? I said, I know you asked me. It was 78 for independence and 22 for whatever. Anyway, I was right. So how do you get that ability? I guess it's by repeated assignments and knowing people and talking to everybody you can, whether military or civilian, whether in the capital or out in the boonies in the villages, and being absolutely straight with your bosses. Remember what my dad told me? Never right. bullshit the old man. So that was that applied to ambassadors and it applied to my superiors in DIA. And that's what I did. And it worked.
How did you develop your relationship with ambassadors? It seems to me like you had an unusually good relationship with your ambassadors, both in Burma and in Indonesia. Clearly, it's something you deliberately developed. How do you build that trusting relationship with the Department of State or with the interagency, as we usually say today, but especially with your ambassador?
Like I say, I was lucky. My ambassadors were all career diplomats. So they had worked with other embassies and other attachés and other military. They had at least a background of what an attaché could contribute to his mission. I was not the least bit shy about calling an ambassador up and saying, sir, you have 10 minutes, I need to chat with you about something. Or him calling me and saying, I need you to come over and we need to talk about this, that, or the other. And just sat down in a, I certainly wouldn't say informal, no discussion with ambassadors right. is informal. But whether it's four eyes or two eyes or however many people are in there, being absolutely straight. And I had to sometimes defend an unpopular train of thought. I had to convince one ambassador whose previous assignments had been dealing with militaries that had really bad reputations. And I had to convince him that the Indonesian military was basically good. They had rough edges, and the rough edges were interfering with our policy. And he would at least give them a benefit of the doubt. And he came to that side. But I had to be able to explain why I said what I said and what my backup was. I had no problem in Burma because Ambassador Levin had been there, done that, his diplomatic experience. And he was a China expert. He'd gone with Henry Kissinger to set up when we recognized the PRC as the government of China. He had a vast experience. And he called me in and said, I'm depending on you and your guys to be straight with me and do what you can. And we just got along really well. He used to say he'd call on a minister who was a military officer, and he says, we've yet to have an intelligent conversation. It's just, oh, right. hello, how are you? Have some tea. And we say what we need to say, and they say what they need to say, and there's right. no interchange of ideas. Minds are already made up. And I said, sir, they're never going to change their mind. It's just that our side has to at least understand where they're coming from. We may not agree with them, and we have to tell them that we don't agree with them, and here's why we don't. And it was the same thing in Indonesia. My ambassador that I spent most of my time with in Jakarta was DCM on one of my assignments, an ambassador when I was the DAT, and he spoke better Indonesian than I did. He could give a speech to the staff college in Indonesian. He sometimes had trouble speaking to the staff at staff meetings. But the man was smart, and he was willing to listen as long as you knew what you were talking about. And I guess that's the key right there, what you're talking about. You're there as a representative of the world, sometimes it seems. You're the representative of the minister, the U.S. Secretary of Defense. You're the representative of the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Armed Forces, the Chief of Staff, the Joint Chiefs. You're the representative of the combat commander, in my case, in Hawaii. And you're the advisor to the ambassador. And I will tell you that I was halfway around the world from Washington and a quarter of the way around the world from Hawaii, but the ambassador was down the hall. Let things fall where they may. When I got in a bit of a huff with DIA, and I was a little bit worried they were going to relieve me for being supportive, my ambassador says, I'm going to call the Secretary of Defense right now.
please,
no, sir, please. It's between us Army guys. I'll go back and I'll fix it. And if I can't fix it, I'll let you know. And then you can call the Secretary of Defense. He didn't need to.
Do you want to get into what the Huff was dealing with?
I just had a reputation of speaking my mind. And sometimes it wasn't 100% what the DIA wanted to hear. But they always knew what I said was what I believed.
And that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you had a lot of relationships with some of the younger FAOs, and it seems to me that you very much appreciated the opportunity to mentor those FAOs. From what you said, it seems like a lot of them went on to have very successful careers. I wonder if you could talk about how you mentored these younger attachés, these younger foreign area officers, through their careers and the choices they made.
If you're the DAT, it's a major part of your responsibility. When I was the A-ARMA, one of my additional duties was to supervise the AIT students that were coming to attend the Indonesian language class, and then a year at the Indonesian Staff College.
I'm sorry, could you say what the AIT is? I'm not familiar with that one.
I'm sorry. I got the wrong letters, maybe. In region, it's now IR.
Okay, gotcha.
I think it used to be Advanced Regional Training. In those days, we got a major. He came and he spent about 4 months attending the Indonesian class. He'd already had Bahasa Indonesia, usually at Monterey. He used that 4 months to meet the other foreign students that would be his classmates at the staff college. And then he had almost a year up in Bandung, up in the hills. And my job was to, I guess you'd say, hold his hand when he needed his hand held, to deliver the groceries when they couldn't get to a grocery or whatever. So I had, as an A-ARMA, I had three truly outstanding young men. They wanted to be mentored. And of course, I wanted to mentor them. One of them became my successor as a defense attaché. One of them became the defense attaché in Malaysia. One of them, an infantry officer, and the infantry branch screwed up and they begrudged him his time away from the mud. And he did not make 06, but he retired and he became a vice president of the most successful and most prosperous and the largest copper and gold mine in the world in Irian Jaya, Indonesia.
Wow.
And he said he spent more time being a FAO as a businessman than he did as an army officer. I didn't have the chance to mentor in Burma, but it was such a small assignment size-wise. I looked for ways to continue to do that after I retired. When I was writing, I wrote probably 250 of my articles have been published, most of them about the Indonesian military. And so I was going back to Indonesia probably twice a year for 10 or 15 years. And I always visited the DAO. I always visited and briefed the DAT on the people I was seeing. All of those guys that were lieutenants were now generals. I was a retired guy, but they still wanted to talk to me. So I had to be sure I was briefed right in the DAO and sometimes by the ambassador before I went to see them. But I always made a point of going back and either talking to them in the DAO or saying, why don't you guys come down to my hotel? We'll have a beer and chat. And most of them wanted to do that. And so I enjoyed that. Out here in Colorado, I don't have the opportunity to mentor as somebody that's stationed in Washington would,
right,
living and retired in the DC area. But up until the last 4 or 5 years, I would still be in Washington for something, either with the U.S. Indonesia Society or FAO functions and what have you. And people still want to talk. And I'm willing to talk, as you can tell today. It's hard to shut me up when I get started. But I don't ever talk about people that don't want to listen. At one time earlier in the FAO Association, you could sign up to be a mentor, which I did. But of course, somebody that's going to go to Indonesia or Burma in Washington has very little opportunity to cross minds with somebody out in Colorado. So I didn't do as much as I would like to. I think even as things have changed, and there's no question that the system is different today, the fact that you are now a full career FAO instead of going back and forth, my uniqueness of my time was doing that. FAOs could not do that.
Right.
Now it's a matter of course. But the main points are still the same. You study hard. You learn your language as best you can. You use it. Anybody that's done this has got all kinds of stories about the fun of being a linguist when you're out in your country. Mm-hmm. And whether it's meeting with your official contacts, military and government, or whether you're in the market and you're trying to bargain with something, or if you're sitting in the back of the local transportation and all the ladies in the front are coming home from the market and they're talking about you.
Right.
And you're just keeping the back of the van and keeping your mouth shut. And while they're discussing everything you can imagine, just imagine. It's a benefit. It's a combat enhancement. We'll call it that. It's a multiplier.
Sure.
And it got to the point in Indonesia where, and I could send in any number of stories about people that forget that you speak their language. It got to the point that Indonesians would speak in Javanese or Balinese around me because they didn't want me to know what they were talking about.
Right.
And of course, I didn't. I'd say language fluency is absolutely crucial, unless you're saying that to someplace like the UK.
Right.
One example. When I was a young major, my first Indonesia assignment, I'm now the Army Division Chief, but we have a responsibility, I probably still do, to report on the use of anything that we give, not sell, give the host country military. And in this particular case, it was the OV-10 aircraft. And that's Air Force, not Army, but for whatever reason, the Air Force Division Chief wasn't available to travel. So I was assigned to go out to the airbase where the OV-10s were based in East Java. And still suspicious of me, the Army Foreign Liaison Officer said, I'll go with you. I'll help you with your appointment. So he did. We got out there. The squadron commander, the OV-10 squadron commander, had been trained in the U.S. He spoke really good English. He gave me a really good briefing in English, but he didn't answer any of the important questions. We told him we needed to know what percent of the aircraft were usable and how many he actually had that could fly right now.
Right.
Didn't mention it. So I asked him, it was all in English up to now, it's all in English. I asked him what his availability rate was and how many he could put in the air today. And he turned to the foreign liaison officer and in Indonesian said, I can give them real numbers or I could make them one up that's a little bit better. And the FLO, who totally lost his mind, answered him in Indonesian, said, give him the better number. As I'm looking at them as they have this little conversation going on, suddenly I see the FLO's eyes get really big. And excuse my language here, but you could see him want to say, oh, shit. Because he knew, of course, that I understood every word that they had just said to each other. And so I said to the young officer in English, I said, you've given me a really good briefing, and I really need to have this information. So would you give me the real numbers? Which he did. And that sort of a thing would happen, I wouldn't say every day, but certainly every week, in which the fact that you spoke the language made a difference in whatever it was that you were doing. The other thing that I would keep talking about is repeat assignments when it's possible.
These days, there is a push from HRC and from assignments managers to make sure that there is a broad regional specialization, and they tend not to want to send you back to countries where you've been before. I can see that you have a different take on that, so I'd love to hear how that has benefited you and how that benefited the U.S. government and the mission to be able to do those repeat assignments.
I can tap dance on that real well. Because the situation is going to be different. Every country is going to be different. Indonesia had assignments that I could go to and fill as a major, as a lieutenant colonel, and as a full colonel. Security assistance, the first time, ARMA, the second time, defense attaché, the second. And I should say I was the SDO DAT in both Burma and Thailand, and Indonesia, before that became official U.S. policy.
Right.
So I had the security assistant side of the house. In Burma, it was handled by my air attaché because we had a very tiny program. In Indonesia, I had a full security assistance organization. It's now called the ODC. Back then, it was the Defense Liaison Group and also headed by an O6. But he worked for me. But anyway, if that possibility exists in a country, I cannot see why the U.S. would not want to do repeat assignments. Maybe not everybody wanted to go back again. That's always an issue. If it's tough for the family or tough for the individual,
right,
or an ugly place or whatever. But I wanted to go back.
And that makes a big difference, too.
It makes a big difference. And so I can understand why this is not possible. In a smaller embassy, there might not be jobs. It may only be one. Maybe two. You could go as a security assistance guy as an 04 or 05 and then go back as the dad as 05 or 06.
Right.
So I would just say that when it is feasible, it should be done because the advantages you get from knowing people, like in my case, was just incredible. when I could pick up the phone and call everybody on the top 20 list in the Indonesian military, at least in the Army and the Armed Forces right. commander, I could do it. And they knew me. They trusted me. I'll give you one more example. When I was the DAT, my ambassador, a terrific boss who had previously been a Navy ROTC cadet, not a career, but he did have his 2 years in the Navy and served on the same destroyer as my Navy attaché. So there was a little help. If there was good news, his policy was the ambassador gives the good news. And if there's bad news, the DAT gives the bad news. And human rights was a big issue in Indonesia, and we had a really major problem. And so he said to me one day, he says, we've just gotten instructions to do a white paper. It's a written document with no letterhead and no signature block on it, and it's a statement of official policy. And so we had a white paper on human rights abuse of a woman who was killed, a labor demonstrator, was killed inside a military base, and later her body was thrown outside, but they knew where it was done. And so I had the duty to take this white paper to the Armed Forces headquarters. So I called up and said, I need to make an appointment with the commander-in-chief. And this man is the one I used to do English conversation back when he was a colonel and I was a major. He's now the commander-in-chief. I get the appointment and I get in the car and I get down to the Armed Forces headquarters, and their foreign liaison officer meets me in the lobby and says, the general is not available. You're going to meet the number two, what they call the chief of general staff, and the assistant for intelligence and the assistant for operations. All three of them I mentioned were either my classmates or my trainees in previous iterations. We went upstairs. They knew why I was there. They had a pretty good idea what I was going to talk about. We had our tea, and then the number two in the armed forces says, okay, John, what do you have to tell us? I literally got the white paper out and said, my instructions are to read this to you and then leave a copy for the commander-in-chief. I said, go ahead. So I read it. It basically said, we know the Army killed this woman. We know that you probably know who did it. We expect there to be a fair investigation and a trial and justice administered. And if not, it will have adverse effect on country to country and military to military relations. So I read that and I put the paper down on the table and I said, sir, that concludes my presentation. Silence is a weapon. There was silence for at least 30 seconds or a minute. And I'm just sitting there waiting for the thundercloud. And so number two in the armed forces looks up at me and he says, John, we understand what is in the paper. I will personally deliver it to the commander-in-chief as soon as he returns. Another long pause, and he says, John, you're still our friend. If I could have cried, I would have cried. But that was certainly to me personally, because of our friendship and our relations over the years. It was also a statement about Indonesia-U.S. Right. friendship. And so I'd done my job. I left a piece of paper on the table, went back to the office. 2 days later, the phone rings. The secretary says, it's the commander-in-chief. I said, oh, okay. Pick up the phone. Yes, sir. Good morning. And he said, basically, John, I'm sorry I wasn't there when you were here the other day. I was in wherever, someplace else. But I have been fully briefed. I have seen the paper that you left with my staff. And I said, I want to tell you personally that I have already taken care of it. We found out who was responsible. He will be given a fair military trial. And if he's found guilty, he will get a fair punishment. It's not going to be in the newspapers, but I want you to tell your ambassador that it's been done. We'll pass that along. That kind of relationship doesn't just happen. You have to work at it. And maybe 2 or 3 years isn't enough time to have that kind of a relationship established. But 5 years, or in my case, from 1978 to 1990, it paid off many number of times. Whether it's that way or whether it's an Army Chief of Intelligence saying, if he said it, you can take it to the bank, that's where your relationships are. You still have a relationship with Washington and with your service and with your combat command. But like I said, Washington was half a world away, and Hawaii was a quarter of the world away, and the ambassador was down the hall. So where do you start?
Exactly. You have to start with those closest to you. Sir, thank you for sharing some incredible stories with us today. Before we wrap up, is there anything else that you want to share or a message that you want to send to the FAO community at large?
I would like to say several things. First of all, like I said, I may be way over the hill now, but I'm still a FAO. And if anybody wants to talk to me, you're welcome to give out my email address. I don't do texting. I do email and telephone. But if anybody wants to talk about specific country issues or specific operational issues, I'm happy to talk. But I'm not going to reach out and say I'm here to talk to you. You're going to have to contact me. Secondly, whether you're in a, let's say, a really comfortable post that you and your family are enjoying it and everyone's having a good time, or whether you're in a shit pot of the world and either your family is not there because it's too dangerous or it's just a little unpleasant, your job is still the same. You still have the same responsibilities as a representative of the United States, as a representative of your armed force, whichever service you're a member of. And it's going to be tough sometime. You're going to have to do things or say things that are going to be unpleasant, and it's your job to do it. I don't know, of all the FAOs I've known, I don't know of anybody that's been relieved for speaking truth to power. It's an important part of any military officer's responsibilities, no matter what their rank, a platoon leader or general officer. When the tough question is given, you have to give the tough answer.
Right.
And it may not be what the boss wants to hear, but it's your job to do it. You speak truth to power. Your reputation is on the line. And so I guess the other thing to say is you're representing the United States overseas. So everything that you do or say is going to reflect on our country. Or whether it's your personal behavior or your professional behavior, just remember that. You're not over there as a tourist. You're there as an official representative of the United States of America. You go over with that thought in the back of your mind, you'll probably do well. One last thing I would like to say is that one of my little side things here is I'm the editor of the Foreign Area Officer Association Journal of International Affairs. We would love to have short articles from the field, from attachés of all services. And if they're well-written, we'll publish them. I'm happy to say that the Army Foreign Area Officer Association is starting its own writing program, and I will be working with Lieutenant Colonel Cheney.
Wonderful.
On some of my publications coming along. So I am always ready to hear from people to tell me what it is, what they've done, interesting things, funny things, serious things that made an impact on their life.
There have been a lot of great articles lately from the FAO Association Journal, and I've very much enjoyed reading those. As an editor, you're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you. I have 12 men on the editorial board, and they do all the red pencil. I just fill in the blanks around the end.
It's a great team, at the very least.
It's an unusual career. I know that there are people in all of the service, but we're talking the Army mostly on this, today, and there are some jobs in the Army that are tough, and I certainly ran into that during my short time in combat. Deployments around the world today are more frequent and more numerous than I can remember. But when you're out there looking around and representing the U.S., there's probably a story or three that you could write down and send in. And other people would benefit from your experience and from the way you handled a tough situation. So
I think that's very true, that most of us undervalue our experiences and undervalue what other people can learn through our experiences.
I agree. And when you're sitting out there a very long way from home plate, sometimes you don't realize you may never have a chance again to be speaking to people at that level of government in another country. Your friends at home are your colleagues, your classmates, you went to a course together, and you just got finished talking to the president or the armed forces chief or the army chief of Y or Z. And you are just fill in the blank, captain, major, colonel. And yet, you're speaking for this country when you do that. And that's an experience that you cannot really put down almost any place else.
Sir, it's been great talking today. Thank you for sharing your story with us. You have had an incredible experience as a foreign area officer and as a Vietnam veteran. I look forward to reading some of those books you mentioned. They are available on Amazon. If anybody wants to reach out to you, is there a good place to do that?
My email is just like my name. It's jhaseman at earthlink.net. And if you send me an email, I will answer. As far as the book, I recommend it to you for a couple of reasons. First of all, I wrote it.
That's fair.
Secondly, it was the description of what led me to become a FAO. I had no experience except that really that second tour, or maybe the last 3 months of my first tour. And those two periods of time of what made me want to be a FAO. As soon as I learned the program was available, I said, that's what I want to do.
Right.
So there's a lot in the book that has to do with working with soldiers of every rank in other countries, but it is also about how to get along, how to learn a culture, how to lose. I had 6 weeks of Vietnamese, but I could talk to the soldiers. It's a good read, and it's not very long. But at the end of it, I'll say what I started at the very part of this discussion, and that is I became a FAO in 1974, and I'm still a FAO. So there it is.
You don't leave behind the soldier when you take off your boots.
That's true.
Again, thank you, sir, and I appreciate you being here today. Look forward to seeing you more downrange.
Okay, Michael, thank you for inviting me. I've enjoyed it very much.